And the Oscar goes to Crash.
The Oscar goes to Shakespeare in Love.
For Best Picture.
You're impossible. Come on. La La Land.
We lost, by the way, but, you know.
Guys, I'm sorry. No. There's a mistake. Moonlight, you guys won Best Picture.
Moonlight won.
Come on, this is not a joke.
This is not a joke. I'm afraid they read the wrong thing.
This is not a joke. Moonlight has won Best Picture. Moonlight, Best Picture.
As far back as I can remember, I always wanted to be a gangster.
I know I'd go back to Texas if you would only say you care. And though my pocket may be empty, I'd be a millionaire. My clothes may still be torn and tattered.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Stuff We've Seen. This is Jim, and now, here he is, just one day away from his quest to become the winner of the 2019 Iditarod, Teal.
I love dog racing.
I know you do, and it's just a day away till you hit.
Yeah, it is. No, here's the funny thing. I know you're joking, and this was a joke intro.
What? No. See, he doesn't want you to know that he's one of the mushers.
But I actually go to dog sled races every year. They happen down the road from me.
Yeah, see? Why would I joke to the people? Come on now, people, come on. I'm an honest guy. As a matter of fact, no liar, pants on fire here. Always topical.
Always topical. My voice is a little off today.
Yeah, so, all right, this is a good little time for me to break in.
Yeah, let's break in here and let's catch our listeners up here.
Okay, so it's been, you know, maybe a few weeks. We were on a roll. There seemed to be an episode every couple of days, and suddenly nothing. So, you know, here's what happened. You know, we have kids, and there's a February vacation in there, and we actually planned for that.
Yes.
We got together on, you know, our channels here. We're not together physically, but we planned on taping a couple of episodes to tide you over, and
yes,
we did that. Yep, and they were, you know, I'd say the first episode was pretty good.
The second one wasn't good. It's a good thing we lost it. Well, you know.
Well, yes, he jumped the lead there. Yes, sadly, somebody and their recording device, I'm not going to mention their name.
Right.
It wasn't me.
It was one of us, and it wasn't you.
Right. Something happened with the recording, and basically it's a lost recording. So, you know, the lost tapes are your end, and anybody who really wanted to hear me drone on.
They're somewhere with Nixon's 18 minutes.
Yes. We'll never get those back. It's just the memories that you and I shared on a fun conversation.
Yes.
Thus, there was no episodes. And then, you know, we planned on taping early in the week this week.
But I lost my voice.
And you did.
Yes.
So we actually... I was like, you know what, the show this time must go on, and my apologies, we had our very special entertainment correspondent Audra on the ready to record. She was going to step in, but then that same day that Teal's voice was completely gone, there was this crazy windstorm happening outside my house, and with the microphone on, it sounded like there was a freight train right outside the window. No kidding. And I put it on about 20 minutes before Audra was going to join in. And I realized that it would be a train wreck. We wouldn't be able to hear anything. So I had to send a message to Audra and say, I'm sorry. So Audra, please forgive us. Sometime in the near future, we will have you on and hear your great entertainment insights.
Yeah, but here we are now. We've made it back to recording a new episode.
Yes, we are back, and a couple of things that got lost when we were taping before. And the first was a shout out to a listener of the show.
Yes.
From Spain. We have somebody that has downloaded every episode, and they're from Spain, and we are very intrigued by you, and we're thankful for your listenership.
And we would think it would be great if you sent us a note.
Yeah, just because we want to know who you are. You're the mystery.
We're curious.
So that is kind of the cool listener shout out. And then one other thing. This is kind of this is what we call, I call it the plate of shrimp, where you're talking about something and then by, you know, magic coincidence, it also happens. For those of you who have listened to our Valentine shows, we mentioned one Valentine film that Teal recommended was Two for the Road.
Yes, with Albert Finney and Audrey Hepburn.
Yes, directed by a very talented filmmaker, Stanley Donen.
Yes.
And then after the taping, one day later, Albert Finney died.
Yes.
And then...
I don't know why I'm laughing. It's just, you know, plate of shrimp.
But before we could even record another episode to talk about that, the director of Two for the Road, Stanley Donen, passed away.
Yes.
Those are two Hollywood legends, and they deserve your respect and certainly to search out their movies. And we'll just say that, you know, we respect them both.
Yes. And I will say, if you're trying to get into Stanley Donen movies, don't start with Saturn III.
Yeah. You know, it's funny. I think that's where I don't know whether it's Amazon Prime or Netflix. Suddenly Saturn III showed up, and I said to myself, why is that up there? Well, that's why it's up there. They've also, Amazon Prime has Gumshoe, which is an Albert Finney movie from the early 70s, and I did add that to my queue because I'm kind of curious.
So Saturn III, I was 9 when Saturn III came out.
And you saw it?
Yes, I saw it. I begged my parents to take me. I don't know why they did. It's rated...
No, it sounds like you're like a sci-fi guy.
I'm like a sci-fi guy, but it's rated R.
Hmm. When have we heard this story before? Rated R movie, Teal's parents. It's not a Disney film, so they're going to take you.
Yes, exactly. It wasn't Disney.
Right. Well, that's what I'm saying. Yeah. It wasn't Disney. So they qualified. Like, I don't care what the ratings are. I actually respect that. I think we're going to do this on a different show. But,
yeah.
You know, ratings, it really depends on a couple things. The kid,
yes.
And then the relationship to the parents. Are the parents going to be able to guide them through these movies, or do they just turn a blind eye and then the kids have to fend for themselves when they have questions?
Well, and also, why is it rated what it's rated? You know, if it's language and nudity, I'm not as strict about it. I'm not even strict about it. I was telling my kids the other day, you can watch any movie you want. These are just suggestions. When it's rated PG-13, yes. It doesn't mean you have to be 13. It's just a suggestion.
Yeah, because kids don't know. They're like, oh, PG-13, I can't see that. I'm not 13.
Yeah, and it really depends on the movie and the kid. My thing with my kids is I don't want you to watch anything that's going to give you nightmares.
Yeah, you have to be smart about what you're letting your kids. My rule of thumb, well, you know, it's different between the two kids. The oldest one, he's always been a very mature film goer. And the more mature film goer, and the more interest he has in seeing those films, he gets to see more.
Yeah,
the youngest one, much different child, and he's not as interested in movies in the first place.
Right.
And so, you know, you have to be just that much more careful. The oldest one now, honestly, he's hit an age where we're watching a lot of films that just happen to be R, sort of that next level of movie going. He's doing well with them. And so the more he's, you know, doing okay, the more he is seeing. And then I guess the thing that's different is when we're seeing the stuff on home, as opposed to going to the theater,
very
to
different,
see rated
yeah.
R, we're able to pause the movie.
And talk about things, yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
We're watching Band of Brothers, and we only have a couple episodes left, and you know, it's something I hadn't seen since it originally premiered in 2001, and forgot just how graphically violent it is.
Well, it's almost like the TV version of Saving Private Ryan.
Well, that's what I forgot. You know, it's only a few years after that came out, and that Saving Private Ryan, people may forget just how groundbreaking that movie was in terms of showing combat.
Yes.
And so when Band of Brothers, they did the very similar approach, but it's like that for an entire 10 episodes.
Yeah.
And yeah, I was worried about him watching it after it started. You know, I was like, oh, what did I get into? But he's been fine with it.
Okay.
Like, he's not, it doesn't faze him. So.
Well, and this was always my parents' thing too, is that there's like good R-rated movies and trash R-rated movies.
Yes.
Now, the reason I brought up Saturn III is it's trash.
That's trash. That is Isn't that Farrah Fawcett's in it, right?
Farrah Fawcett, Kirk Douglas, and Harvey Keitel.
Oh, Keitel.
Have you seen it?
I want to be honest, because that's how I am. Just like I can tell you that he is running the Iditarod tomorrow. I have not seen it.
Okay. I haven't seen it since 1980. But even then, as a kid who loves science fiction movies, I thought it was bad.
I was like my oldest son back when I was 10. I was, you know, a fairly astute critic of films, and if I knew a movie like Saturn III, which I was too young to see when it came out because my parents didn't take me to see a film like that, but if I heard it was garbage ahead of time and not like, oh, this movie is so bad, but you got to see it, I just stayed away from it. I didn't need to see movies that were intentionally bad,
right?
Even though I saw my fair share as I became a moviegoer seeing movies, you know?
Yeah.
But here's the film that we're watching now. and he likes it so far, I think. And we've kind of finished kind of one big story, and we still have like an hour and a half to go. And it gets worse from there, so I'm not sure. But we've kind of we went down this path, and we can't go back. We're watching Pulp Fiction.
What?
My wife and I and my, we're watching it together. And
what?
And talking. Yes, I know. It's crazy. It's wrong.
that's just wrong.
It is wrong, but he's a good film student. Oh, we told him you cannot, this is one you shouldn't probably tell your friends you're seeing. Because then it'll be one of those, like, you can't hang out with that kid because his parents let you see Pulp Fiction.
My daughter was saying that a lot of kids that she goes to school with lie about what movies they've seen.
That's what happened with my son. He used to say there was this one girl at school like 3 years ago that said that she watched The Walking Dead. But she couldn't tell you anything about it.
Right, right. But it's usually somebody who has an older sibling who's told them about it, and they like to brag, oh, I saw R-rated movies.
Yes. But he's the kid that will have actually...
he's the kid who's actually seen Pulp Fiction.
Yeah, a few weeks ago he watched The Big Lebowski. He loved it.
Well, I get that. That's different than Pulp Fiction.
Well, you know why he got to see that? Is the kids today, they come back from school reciting these memes.
Yes, yes.
And they don't even know what the memes are. So all of a sudden, both my oldest son and my youngest son, because he's the copycat, were walking around the house going, give us the money, Lebowski. Talking just like that. We want some money, Lebowski. And I'm like, do you even know what you're talking about? And my son would look at me and go, no.
So did your, I'm going to segue here. Did your kids watch the Oscars?
Okay, my son actually did watch the Oscars for the first time. And because it moved so quickly, he stayed up all the way through Best Actress and went to bed at like 5 of 11 because he couldn't, you know, he just was too tired and missed Best Picture. He didn't realize that Best Picture was the only other award that hadn't been given out. So the next day he was like, oh man, I missed that. Yeah, but my youngest could care less. But the, you know, the 10 and a half year old, he's now interested. And he'd actually seen some of the movies, you know, this year. So he had a vested interest in just the fact that he'd seen some of the films.
Yeah, yeah, my kids, same thing. My 6 year old loves it, but mostly,
Your six-year-old likes watching the Oscars?
Yes.
That's really kind of fascinating. What does she like about it?
She likes the fashion.
Okay.
Mostly, though, she likes the musical performances.
Well, that's kind of cool.
Yeah.
Which is why, this is why the people were up in arms for the weeks leading up to the Oscars in the first place about them wanting to cut this or cut that. Because if you're somebody who still even, like, likes to watch the Oscars, you like to watch all of that stuff. Yes. And if you start cutting out those things, you're really taking away what makes that show worth watching in the first place.
Exactly. Yep.
You know, to me, here's this funny thing. I've watched the Oscars. I was like, I probably started watching them when I was around 10.
Yeah.
And I became obsessed with wanting to see the whole show. And there was a year that I decided, I was maybe like 13 or something.
Yeah.
This was the year that I was going to watch the whole thing. But my parents would only let me stay up to a certain point. So, like, this is, you know, this is just how geeky I am. Leading up to the Oscars, for about a month and a half, I had been very, very sick. And when you were very, very sick, you got the portable black and white TV
right.
in your room.
Yep.
And you got to have it in your room because you were sick. So I just never put it back downstairs. Right? And so it was this elaborate plan where I never turned it on. I didn't give my parents any reason to think that the TV needed to go back down. So I had that. And then I built this sort of elaborate thing of like a tent I built like sheets and stuff, and then I took some sheets and put that under the crack of the door, and I did, you know, test runs.
Right.
Where I wanted to see how low did I have to make the sound, because there was no headphones or anything, to this black and white TV. So it was all set. Like, I'd done all the dry runs, perfect timing. So night happens, right? My parents say, okay, it's time to go to bed. Instead of me going, can I have another 20 minutes? I just said, okay, I'm ready. Good night. And I go into my room and I get it all set up and I turn it on. And I'm like, yes. And I turn the TV on and I have it on for about 5 minutes and somebody wins an award. And my dad was so excited about whatever what he decided to come in and tell me about it because he figured I'd still be awake. And then they're like, the door won't open because there's sheets there. And they're like, what's going on? And I'm like, oh. And then, so now it's defeat.
Right.
And my dad goes back, whatever. And instead of like, now I'm in trouble for this, they thought it was the funniest thing ever that I wanted to see the Oscars so bad that I would go to all this trouble that then I get a knock on my door about 5 minutes later and they say, you can just come out and watch it.
That's great.
And then they went to sleep even, and I'm out there watching the whole thing. And at that point, I got to watch them all the time. So,
right. You
know, I was way into this for years. I don't know why, because my movies never win.
So it must have been 1980 or 81, The Empire Strikes Back was nominated for special effects.
We're talking about the year 80. It gets nominated at 81. So
yeah.
It would have been the 81 Academy Awards.
Exactly. Yes. So those, you know, I don't know why, but for some reason, that was the year that I felt like I really wanted to watch the Oscars.
I totally remember watching it. That was probably my year, too.
As you remember, we didn't have television at our house.
Oh, so what do you do?
So we didn't have cable, and because we were too rural for cable.
Yeah, and you didn't need it, though, because it was on regular national TV.
Right, but we couldn't get any reception. We were out in the middle of nowhere, and we couldn't get any reception. I mean, sometimes you could get really snowy, fuzzy kind of, but mostly no reception. And so my father took me to his place of work. He worked at a college, and he set me up with a little TV cart in a classroom by myself.
That's awesome.
And he went to his office and did work and basically let me stay up until 11 or so by myself in this classroom watching the Oscars. And I did that several years in a row.
If you're listening to the show, you're probably somebody who, you know, this is exactly your story, right? You just love to watch these things. Though I bet you, just like, you know, I was at that age, I was naive enough to really believe that some movie that I really liked, even though I'd already, you know, I was into it enough to know that, like, they were already predicting who was the favorite of the Oscars. And inevitably, that favorite would usually win. It was very few surprises even back then. But, you know, before the internet, most people who would tune in had no idea who was going to win.
Right.
You know, even though if you followed along and read trades and things or watched like Entertainment Tonight, they'd talk about what movie was really, you know, their experts predicted.
I didn't get any of that, though, because we didn't have TV, so I got none of that.
Did you know who all the nominees were? Like,
yes, because I would see that in the paper.
Okay, so because I, like, when the nominations would happen, before you'd even get a chance to see them live.
Right.
In the East Coast, I couldn't wait for the paper to come out that shows all the nominees. Like, yes. What happened is Entertainment Tonight at like 7 would go over what movies got like 10 nominations or something. And they talk about what got nominated for Best Picture or Best Actor or Actress. But all of the other trades, craft awards, they wouldn't mention those. So I'd have to wait till it was in the paper the next day. And then I would cut it out. So I had my whole...
had your checklist.
And I tried always to see as many of the nominated films, even in obscure categories, so I could really make my own judgment of what I thought was the best film. This is how I operated as like a 12, 13, 14-year-old. and it really went up for many years, and now I don't. But, you know, in the interest of time, I'm going to throw out some things.
Here, okay.
So take a listen here. I'm going to throw out a bunch of film names.
Okay.
Drugstore Cowboy.
Yes.
Sex, Lies, and Videotape.
Yes.
Do the Right Thing.
Mm-hmm.
The Fabulous Baker Boys.
Mm-hmm.
Crimes and Misdemeanors.
Mm-hmm.
Henry V. Mystery Train. Roger and Me. Glory. Enemies, a Love Story. Parenthood. When Harry Met Sally. That's a pretty impressive list of movies. People can agree or disagree on the quality.
No, but it's a pretty good list of movies. Yeah.
Like in that list, you could almost make up a 5 Best Picture nominees.
Yes.
All of those films are from the year 1989. Now, I'm gonna give you 5 other films.
Yeah.
Born on the 4th of July. Field of Dreams. Dead Poets Society. My Left Foot. And Driving Miss Daisy.
Yeah.
Those were also from 1989.
Yes, and they were all the Best Picture nominees.
And those were the 5 nominees for Best Picture that year, with 2 exceptions in directing. In directing, Crimes and Misdemeanors and Henry V replaced Field of Dreams and Driving Miss Daisy.
Right.
And I think those were definitely 2 better choices. Now, that year really stuck out in the history of the Academy Awards, for me and many others, because there are so many great films that came out in 1989.
Yeah, yeah.
And so many of them, they're so far more original, of the moment, experimental, daring.
What was the first film on your list again?
Drugstore Cowboy.
Okay, yeah, Drugstore Cowboy, that's right. And Sex, Lies, and Videotape were both sort of visionary independent films.
Drugstore Cowboy at the time, and I'm talking about the time that it was released, it was a smaller film.
Yeah.
It was a critical favorite. And so I can understand why that might not have made the cut, though a lot of people thought maybe.
Yeah, but I can see it flying under the radar.
But Sex, Lies, and Videotape. And you know, again, some of these movies I'm talking about of their time.
Yeah.
They may not have aged well, but Sex, Lies, and Videotape was a revolutionary game changer in terms of independent cinema.
Yes, absolutely.
So that itself, when it didn't get nominated, was a shock.
Yeah.
Now, Do the Right Thing. Critics, you know, loved it. I, at the time, I have to admit, when I first saw it, I just didn't think it was that great.
Interesting.
But I'm just being honest. You know, I saw it that summer, first week. I was very excited. Maybe it was one of those things where I was overhyped to think it was the next greatest thing ever.
Right.
And I thought it was fair, but good. But when you look at what the 5 films that actually got nominated for Best Picture, and you think of Do the Right Thing, it was groundbreaking.
Yep.
It had something to say. It talked about race relations in a way that certainly no white filmmaker had done before and wasn't doing. And you had a up-and-coming, on-the-rise, brilliant filmmaker who was even, like, the way it was shot, the way edited.
No,
nothing about this film is the way movies you saw, and that was reflective of the fact that we have a new voice.
Well, it was, and a voice with vision.
Exactly.
Right, a unique voice that has a unique way of looking at the world that's totally individual to that writer, director, creative person, And they come across as a unique voice, not just yet another Hollywood voice.
Think about just the way the film opened. A lot of people, even like, you know, regular filmgoers, were kind of off-put.
Yeah.
You know, there's Rosie Perez doing some weird dance with boxing gloves.
Yes.
And it was not the way you're supposed to open a movie.
No.
And it just said that this is a filmmaker who's thinking differently about film.
Yes. And one thing I think about that movie is that the movie ultimately is a question, not a statement.
Yes.
And that demands more of the audience.
You know, in the history aspect of things, you look back, and even though I made a very long list,
yeah,
you see a lot of great films that could have easily slid in there. And I mention these because I remember 1989 very well and know that each and every one of them was brought into the conversation by somebody as a potential,
yeah,
movie that could have been nominated. And when you think of the fact that Driving Miss Daisy not only was one of the nominees, and out of all those films that I listed, that would not even be in the list.
No.
In my opinion.
It's a really mediocre movie.
Yeah, and it wins Best Picture when a movie like Do the Right Thing isn't even nominated.
Isn't even nominated, yeah.
It sent reverberations, shockwaves.
Yes, it did.
Literally, it signified a moment that, even in filmmaking, it turned the page into, say, when we're dealing with films about race relations between white people and African-American people, the question is, what lens are we seeing these,
yes,
films through?
Yeah.
And so with that, I say to you, on the scale of Oscar injustices, how bad is it that Green Book won Best Picture? Tell me the truth.
It's pretty bad.
I think so, too.
And it's bad for a number of reasons.
Well, it's weird as the narrative 29 years later.
Yeah.
We finally... Spike Lee has had a very interesting film career. He's made some near great films. I think his best film was Malcolm X.
I really like He Got Game. Along the way, he's had some pretty great little movies that maybe haven't gotten as much notice as his other movies.
Yeah, and I think his reputation started slipping a bit. And what happened is it was getting harder and harder for him to finance anything.
Yes.
So he took on projects that really, the last several years, he's made things that no one's seen.
Right, like that Old Boy remake. His bank robbery movie did pretty well.
Any great filmmaker who makes films that maybe are a little bit out of the box and,
yeah,
not quite the normal Hollywood narrative, I always say, what would happen if they had to make a standard Hollywood film? Could they do it?
Yeah.
And Spike Lee was one of those filmmakers that I said, if he had to play by all the rules of Hollywood, could he make a film that was just your standard, like, go to the, you know, movies on Friday night?
Right.
And he did. And
he
it
did.
Was a very good movie.
Yeah, he totally pulled it off.
But he comes back to form with Black Klansman.
Right.
And I've already said it wasn't necessarily my favorite film of the year, but there are powerful moments. And I think that Spike Lee does something that looks... It looks very simplistic.
Right.
He's going from an angle that maybe only a person who's African-American could go at that angle much differently than if it was,
right,
if it was a white filmmaker making that story. And that's where it's interesting that this finally gets him an Oscar nomination,
right,
for Best Director and Best Picture. And what does it have to do is it goes up against this film,
Green Book,
which was directed by a comedy film director.
Yes.
And it probably started out as a fun story of a memory of one of the screenwriter's dad.
Yeah.
And in typical, I guess, white filmmaking fashion, they probably didn't give a lot of thought about the cultural impact and the idea that you're,
exactly,
making a story about a white Italian American who's, hey, you know, it's racist by today's standards.
Right.
I'll throw in a few bad words. And then you have the smart, educated, very talented, artistic person who happens to be of color in a time that there's all this racism and segregation in the,
right,
South. And they need a white bodyguard to guide them through.
Yes.
True story, yes. But now through the lens of the white filmmaking group.
Yes, the white filmmaking group, but also the white character. He's the main character. So it's about, you know, because he's the main character, it's about a white guy sort of realizing what racism is and then seeing it in himself and overcoming it.
And you know, I am not. I don't have necessarily a problem with that.
No, I think that's a fine narrative. But here, I mean, I have so many issues with this film. But here's just one: is that what's his name? The Mahershala Ali character,
Doc Shirley.
Yeah, I just thought of them through the whole movie as Tony and the Doc.
Tony and the Doc.
You know, and it's basically a road buddy comedy movie.
Which is where I found the most success of the film, when it felt like it was a two-buddy movie.
Exactly.
Going through buddy things.
The Doc is actually the more interesting character. There's a moment in the movie where he sort of breaks down and he says, I'm not white enough for this culture and I'm not black enough for this culture. I'm all alone.
And yeah, and we'd love to explore that. And then they don't explore that because that's the point of a movie that is basically directed through the lens of white people. They are interested only to a point of his story.
Yeah, and his story to me is the more interesting story, and he should have been the main character.
The best thing in the movie is Mahershala Ali's performance.
Yes.
And I don't feel it's a supporting performance.
It's not.
I feel it's a lead performance.
It's a lead performance. It's a co-lead. It's a co-lead, yeah. Because of the way the story is set up, Tony is the main character.
Here's why I think Green Book got into trouble.
Yeah.
Oscars, like everything, is about a political campaign.
Exactly.
And rather than the Academy taking the stance that they are going to have a committee that when movies are submitted for initially nominations, they should decide, not the filmmakers, but they should decide if a performance is a lead or
right.
supporting.
Yes.
And this way, you know, like a couple of years ago, Viola Davis won Best Supporting Actress for Fences.
Yes.
And it was a powerful performance. And she certainly deserved an award, but she was a best actress and not a supporting in that
right.
film. And there's no way she should have been
supporting. And this happens all the time with...
Yeah, but it really bothers me. I think this is one of... When we talk about all the problems of the Academy Awards, it's all this politics to get somebody an award. So basically, they decided they wanted to get Mahershala Ali an award. And
right.
the way that they had to do that was supporting category. And, you know, it's not gone unnoticed to me that in many recent years... The supporting
yes.
actor or actress has gone to an African American,
yep.
but sometimes that performance really could have been a lead. And
yes.
it feels a little racist that the studio is like, we're going to put you in the supporting category. And that bothers me that they basically decided that this is going to be the white savior story
right.
because he's going to be the lead and Mahershala is going to be the supporting actor and we're going to submit it that way.
And it just confirms, it's just a confirmation of everything that's wrong with the movie. Sort of bringing this back a little bit, my kids, of course, watched the Oscars, as we talked about, and my six-year-old wanted to know what Green Book was about. Mostly, she was fascinated by how old Aragorn looks.
Yeah, right. He was, you know, by the way, the real character was in his 30s.
I know, yeah.
And Viggo was 60 or 61.
Yeah.
So,
so she asked me what Green Book was about. And I explained to her, you know, the plot of these two guys, and they're going to the South, and there's a lot of whites-only stuff in the South, and so they have this green book that tells them where they can stay. And she says, that sounds kind of racist.
I mean, you know, that's the point. It was.
And I said, yeah, actually, that's exactly the point. Yes, that's, you know, it's actually a really important story this movie is telling. And what I realized after talking to her about it and seeing the film and thinking about it is that it's a kid's movie. If they took out the swearing, there's a little bit of swearing, it would be rated PG. And it's basically a movie to teach kids about race. It's about as sophisticated in its view on race as a six-year-old can handle.
I wish they'd just own up to it. The fact is that this movie was cleverly created and packaged
yes.
by white people to really provide an audience, the mass audience, and say, here's an acceptable, fun way to look at a very dark time that
exactly.
a lot of you older folks will remember, but you can remember it this way, that
yes.
it seems a little bit
with
maybe...
With this sort of glossy comedy take on it, where every moment in the film is like a little lesson on racism.
Like, they were arrested, or somebody in this movie was arrested, what, three times
yes.
in the film? And And none of those times did I ever feel for one second real danger.
No, not at all. There's no danger in the movie at all. There's no real threat at any point.
And I know, I guess it's that the idea is that if it's supposed to be sort of a lighthearted comedy, but do you know what I mean? Like, if you don't feel, when you're down in the deep south, I never felt for one second, boy, this is a scary, scary thing for Don Shirley to have to go through.
Exactly. Yeah, I mean, maybe the scene in the bar is probably the closest that it gets to him actually being physically threatened.
And you know what really bothered me? And you know, I'm getting on, these are just, it just, I'm going to just tell you the things that bothered me. It's, again, when this movie, what bothered me worse than it winning Best Picture was winning Best Original Screenplay, because this movie just checks every obvious box. And I knew for a fact, the way it had been set up, a couple of things that just jumped out. And maybe it was the not so great filmmaking. Because, I mean, thankfully, Peter Farrelly, I mean, I like him. He just didn't know how to direct a movie like this.
No, there's, that's my...
There's the scene, the tip-off in the bar towards the end where he's flashing out money.
Yes.
And then you cut to the obvious shot of a couple of guys looking. I'm like, oh, those guys are going to meet him out in the parking lot. And then somehow, magically, Viggo Mortensen still has his gun that would have been confiscated when they were arrested.
Exactly.
That's just, to me, it's not, that's one of those sort of believable things that's lazy. And then... I knew for a fact they were going to come back to being stopped at the end of the movie by a cop.
Yes.
But this time it's the friendly cop who just wants to make sure they're okay.
Right, because they're in a place where it's snowing. If it's snowing, you know you're in the north, and then people aren't racist in the north.
It's horrible. I mean, again, when you start to break it down, it's embarrassing.
Yes, this movie is really a mess in terms of its racial politics. I need to make another point about this movie that you just brought up. It is so blandly directed. There is not a single interesting shot in this movie. The framing, the camera movement, the editing, everything is as though it's done by a Hollywood algorithm.
Peter Farrelly, that's like, he's sort of like Kevin Smith. Kevin Smith is known for one thing, his funny dialogue, I guess, but man, he cannot direct a scene.
There's nothing bad about the direction. It's entirely competent. It doesn't stand out as going, oh, well, this, like with Kevin Smith, it stands out how bad the direction and the editing is.
It's to the letter. They're very finely produced.
Exactly. It's very finely produced. And it basically looks like a TV movie just on the pure level of cinema. Take out all the other things. There's nothing interesting about this movie on the level of cinema. And the screenplay has no story. It's just a series of little anecdotes.
Did you find that the first sort of 15 to 20 minutes of this movie, Peter Farrelly had a really hard time getting this movie going?
And it was about 15 or 20 minutes in, and I found the movie absolutely unbearable. I didn't know if I would be able to finish watching it. Once the two of them start interacting, the movie has some charms.
Well, that's the thing is, you and I, we love road movies, right?
Yes.
So in the road movie sort of rule book and aspect, I enjoyed that journey. To a degree.
No, and the two guys are charming at times, and, you know, I got a couple of chuckles. Eventually, I just said, okay, the movie sucks. I just kind of got to get any kind of pleasure I can out of it. The whole setup of Tony's character, the opening 3 or 4 minute sequence of him working in the club.
That, to me, was so bad a setup because it didn't really make much sense.
It makes no sense, and it has nothing to do with the rest of the movie. He takes this guy's hat and uses it to sort of it's this little, like, bullshit maneuver.
I'm clapping because this is my problem with the way it started. I was like, what does this hat have to do with anything? It doesn't.
An example of probably one of the best screenplays ever written, Chinatown, opens with a scene with Jake Getty's talking to a client, and it looks as though it's just one of these little character intro bits that doesn't have a lot to do with the movie. It just sort of establishes he's a private detective and this is one of his clients, played by Burt Young, I think, and it is just one of these little intro bits. But then, like, 3/4 of the way through the movie, he meets up with the character again, and it is part of the movie. It's not just a throwaway to establish the character. And in Green Book, it's a complete throwaway to establish the character. It has nothing to do with the story. It has nothing to do with anything. It could be cut out. In fact, you could cut the first 15 minutes out. In fact, you should cut the first 15 minutes out of this movie and just start with the doc as the main character interviewing people for this job. Every single beat in this movie is as obvious and as simplistic as it could possibly be. There's no complexity in its discussion about race. There's people that are racist, and there's people that are not racist, and there's people that are kind of learning to be one or the other. Everything is simplified in a way that a child could understand racism. And I seriously, I want to show this movie to my kids because I think it's an important kids film.
And this is one, you know, thing I think is a credit. I didn't know who Don Shirley was before. Right. I'm not saying that now I get the great idea, but like he was a person that, and I think this is probably, honestly, I think that the filmmakers probably went in with great intentions. We're going to tell a story about a person that people don't know about. We want his story told. And also a lot of people had no knowledge of this thing called the Green Book.
Right.
And it's another blemish on American history that African Americans could not travel through the South safely.
Yeah.
And that they needed a guide of where they could eat, where they could sleep, and what towns they couldn't go in after dark.
Exactly. I mean, that's insane. The sundown towns. Yeah.
And so I think that if you look at it from people who go in and knew nothing about this,
yeah,
and they got something out of, and they felt good afterwards, and they felt entertained, great. That's not our job.
Oh, I'm not begrudging anyone enjoying this movie. I get that it's enjoyable. I get, you know, some of the comedy is good. It's charming at times. It checks all the right boxes. It pushes all the right buttons. It knows exactly what it's doing. It perfectly emotionally manipulates the audience. It ends with a freaking Christmas dinner.
That also I felt was one of the more false aspects of this movie.
It, totally false and manipulative. I'm just going to make this point again. I've made it like six times already. The Don Shirley character should have been the main character. He is the more interesting character, and it took a long time into the movie for me to get his backstory, and when it came, it was all delivered through dialogue, but it's actually a really fascinating story, this guy, and how he was raised, and how he was educated, and he's essentially a child prodigy, and that's an interesting character in any movie outside of the racial issues.
Yeah, and but then that's, again, shows where the problem is that...
I don't think this movie is racist.
No. That I don't think is what this is at all. I just feel that this was a nice little comedy, and it had no business even being nominated for Best Picture.
Absolutely.
And since it did win, it's a topic that we're talking about. You know, here's the thing is that entire list of movies of the eight nominated films...
Yeah.
There's a no-win situation when it comes to the Oscars. No. I can tell you, no matter what film won... out of that list, people would be complaining about that film.
Yes.
You know, Roma is not for most audiences.
Right.
I think it's a rewarding experience, and I think it's way different. You know, people, the reason why Green Book won and Roma didn't is because people, when they watched it, the 7,000 member body, they're just regular people, but some of them happen to have jobs, and you know, they have jobs in Hollywood. And that's really their only qualification, and they're in the Academy. It doesn't mean they're like some scholar of movies.
Right.
They just happen to, you know, work as a trade in the industry, and they've been, you know, nominated to be in the Academy.
When they like movies like Green Book that are essentially Hollywood patting itself on the back for not being racist.
Well, or they just like they're just as a regular film goer. They're also they voted for Bohemian Rhapsody because they liked the concert at the end of the movie.
Yeah.
Right. These aren't people that are film scholars. And then they watch a film like Roma. They recognize the craft and that they recognize that I probably should love this movie. But admittedly, it's not their kind of film. So they say, yeah, I'm going to, you know, give him the best director.
Right.
But I'm going to vote for Green Book. And you know what? If Green Book hadn't squeezed through the director's branch and had been nominated, I bet you it had a shot at winning Best Director, too, because that's just how people
That's just how are. It rolls, yeah.
And lately, I have to say, there's been a different sort of pattern where for years, Best Picture and Director were almost lockstep.
Yes.
And in the last 20 years, that has changed a lot.
That has changed a lot. So, okay, thinking about this year's Oscars and then going back to 1989 again. For a minute.
Yes.
Of those films that were nominated in 1989, Field of Dreams is the only one I've seen again since 1989.
It's funny. You know, at the time, I love that movie. But it was, again, it was like this feel-good movie.
Yeah.
And sure, and I think there's an argument to be made. Is it fair? Does a film have to be, like, you know, beautifully, like, brilliantly framed and complex and amazing perform to be a best picture?
Not necessarily.
And I would say no. Field of Dreams, I'm going to be honest. I don't know whether it's because my father is no longer here. And I didn't have a very good adult relationship with him. But I will tell you that a few years ago, I watched Field of Dreams with my son, and he really enjoyed it.
Yeah.
And I was hiding tears throughout that.
Yes.
I found it really great. And I think that's a power that's just as equally important. So it's funny, but like you said, I've seen Field of Dreams probably a good half a dozen times.
Yeah, me too.
Dead Poets Society didn't mean as much to me as it meant to my wife. I've seen it a couple of times. I still think it's a good movie, but maybe not a best picture.
Yeah. I mean, none of these movies are bad. The point I'm making is, what are the movies that are still going to be watched even in 10 years?
Yeah. Well, that's the thing. So Born on the 4th of July, have you tried watching that one lately?
No. I have not seen it since. I saw it twice in the theater.
I was with you with one of those two times.
At the Ziegfeld, I believe.
Yes.
Yes.
And you know what? That was a great thing because that was the second time I saw it. And the first time I was not impressed. I was more impressed seeing it in 70mm at the Ziegfeld. But still, it's Oliver Stone when he was making good movies, but it's, you know, there's not much to that movie.
No, it's really heavy-handed and fairly simplistic, and it, you know, it's got some good filmmaking. Again, not that these are bad movies. It's more a question of what's memorable. And, you know, if you look back to a decade ago even, what from 2009's nominations are we still watching?
See, I'm having a hard time not even thinking about what movie was the big film in 2009. What won Best Picture that year?
Hurt Locker. Hurt Locker won.
I didn't like Hurt Locker.
Yeah.
Am I allowed to say that?
Yes,
I just thought
yes,
it was
you are.
Whatever. I just thought that was a film where it seemed to be the right movie for the Academy to finally reward a female film director. I didn't think it was a very good movie.
I think that, and I think there was also something about dealing with the war in Iraq that needed to be done in terms of Hollywood.
And I also feel that it was a way of saying, not this time, James Cameron.
Okay, so I'm going to quickly read you the nominations from 2009.
Okay, well, Avatar was one.
Avatar, The Blind Side, District 9, An Education, Inglourious...
Love that movie.
Inglourious Bastards.
I like that too.
Precious, A Serious Man, Up, and Up in the Air.
I liked Up in the Air a lot, too.
No, there's some good movies on this list, but
Up was great, too.
I would argue that the only ones that are really lasting from that are Up and Inglourious Basterds.
Yeah, Up in the Air, people don't watch that.
And people don't watch.
It was about the financial collapse and corporations letting people go.
Yeah.
Probably not a movie you want to visit too often.
It's a good movie. I liked it. But again, is it lasting? Is it memorable? Are people going to be watching it in 20 years? And I kind of... And so this is my argument about Green Book, is I feel like Green Book is ultimately going to be forgettable.
At least at the moment, the present moment, I feel that films that we're going to still be talking about in 10 years, is Cold War.
Yes.
Which, by the way, we had a little discussion on that film that we'll have to get into that because it got lost in our in our deleted
conversation. And we definitely need to talk about it.
But Cold War, Roma, and The Favorite are movies that I would remember in 10 years.
Absolutely, yeah. Those movies, I mean, The Favorite, I watched, I don't know, 2 weeks ago now, and I watched it the night before we taped, and I had some issues with it. Then we lost that episode. But The Favorite has stuck with me since I watched it. It got under my skin. It affected me. And it stayed with me. You know, if a movie doesn't stay with you, like, within the first week of watching it, it's probably not going to stay with you for 20 years.
It's sometimes you walk away from a film and your instant reaction's like, oh my God, that was great. And then, you know, it starts to fade pretty quick. And then a day or two, you're like, what movie did I just see?
Exactly. Yeah, you can barely even remember it. But like The Favorite keeps coming back to me. Cold War keeps coming back to me. Even The Rider keeps coming back to me.
My top five were in no particular order with like The Rider, The Favorite, Cold War, Roma, and First Reformed. Those are like... Honestly, I don't need beyond that for top because those five I'm going to remember for a long time. And then the other five that just made out a top 10 list of movies I enjoyed, and I'm probably not going to remember which year they came out.
Exactly. Yeah, and so what's really memorable, I think, is more important than what wins the awards that year.
What I'm not going to forget from this award ceremony is the fact that Bohemian Rhapsody won four Oscars. And honestly, it did not deserve any of those four.
No.
Especially film editing, which...
Oh.
That is ridiculous.
Yeah.
That it won Best Film Editing.
And didn't it win some sound awards too?
Yeah. Well, you know, because it was a concert. I feel that this is a legitimate problem. The Academy, all 7,000 members, they get to vote for all the awards.
Yes.
Once the nominations are out, except for, I think, for like the short subjects, they have to go to the screenings and then check it off. But you know, they aren't the people who are best suited to pick those categories. And like any change they would like to enact in the Academy, you're never going to get all the members to say, oh, I'll just vote for what I am, you know, qualified for. They're going to want to vote for everything, and that's just how it's going to be.
Exactly. And a movie like Bohemian Rhapsody, which didn't have a director.
Yeah, nobody thanked the director that night. I wonder why that movie, that they always thank the director, he wasn't thanked.
Yeah, but I actually think the movie did not have a director. I think it just had producers.
Well, you had somebody going through their own crisis.
Right.
And they left, and we'll never get the straight story about how much he really filmed and how much had to be refilmed.
Right.
But
basically, it was directed by the producers.
Well, they brought in this guy, and I don't know how Dexter Fletcher, he's a British former actor. He took over. I don't know, you know, how they got him, but, you know, to no deference to him, if you have to suddenly join a production a few weeks before it's going to be finished, all you're doing is trying to make sure that the scenes get in there.
You're just making your days, and you're trying to make the movie look and act like everything that's been shot so far before.
You know, this is just your picadillos and mine. When I'm judging a movie and how good it is, I want to feel like there's a director behind the scenes thinking shots out, giving me something.
Yes.
And that's where, you know, and again, you have to finish watching Black Klansman. I over time, now that it got nominated, you know, I always rethink things through. And, you know, it has some Spike Lee touches. And again, I think the point is, bringing it back to the beginning, these are touches that you might not have had, or you definitely would not have had a white director made the movie. And things that he's doing, he's playing with a white audience's expectations of what a genre movie like that is supposed to be.
Oh, that's interesting.
And that's why you haven't seen the end, because he plays out the film as if it's what a white audience might expect. And then he goes for the kill in, I told you, the best ending of any film last year that I saw. And it's so powerful. But it's not just because the ending is a powerful piece, but it's only powerful in the context of, like, he says, ha ha, you fell for this bullshit, and here's the bullshit that's really going on, you stupid white motherfuckers. That's what's so brilliant, because it is. It's like, God damn it, Spike Lee, you've done it.
Yeah.
And
okay, don't talk about it too much more, because I want to see it.
I know. But one trademark that he makes, and you know what? At first, when he first started doing it in his early movies, I was like, what the hell is this showy crap? But then I started to look forward to it, and he got better and better at using it, which is his characters moving towards you.
Oh, yes, on a dolly. Yep, the famous Spike Lee dolly shot, yeah.
That's him. Nobody else created, that's him creating something unique to film, and now I look forward to it.
Yes, me too.
And he actually, like in Malcolm X, it's like he built something up so that when it happens in Malcolm X, it's so brilliant.
Yes.
And I feel that he uses it brilliantly again in this movie. So there's a director behind the movie there. And Green Book, you don't even know who could have directed that movie.
Any Hollywood journeyman could have directed Green Book and done just as fine a job.
Last year, there were no exciting, shocking wins at the Oscars. And that's part of the fun of watching them, is to see something surprising.
Yeah.
So even if I don't necessarily agree that it's my choice, sometimes I just love something unexpected happening.
Right.
And there were some surprises this year. There was a couple of wins. I mean, the Black Panther wins. I did not think that's a movie that should have got nominated for anything.
Right.
But it did, and it won a couple things. And you know what? There was some history made there, so I'm happy.
Yeah, yeah.
Olivia Colman winning.
She was my pick.
I have not seen, in fairness, I did not see Glenn Close's performance in The Wife, and probably a lot of other people didn't.
Yeah.
Melissa McCarthy would have been my choice. She was amazing.
Right.
And when people finally get to see that film, they're going to actually wonder why that wasn't nominated for Best Picture. But just the fact that, you know, when people out there, when we read articles and people just say, oh, Glenn Close, she's got it locked, you know, yeah, she's been nominated a bunch of times, but I want to take people back, and these are the performances she was actually nominated for. She was nominated for World According to Garp.
Right.
Supporting actress. It's a small role.
It's a small role, yeah.
She got nominated, but it's not like it would not have won, and it didn't. The Big Chill, she was fine in that.
She was fine,
You know, The Natural, you know, she's fine in that.
Yep.
Dangerous Liaisons, she was very good.
Yeah, she's very good in that.
And then Albert Nobbs, that was her getting a nomination because they felt that she was deserving. And then also she was in Fatal Attraction, which was a sensational thriller movie, and she should be lucky that she got nominated for that. And so, you know, you look at what she's been nominated for, to just say she's owed an award for a movie that apparently, other than her performance, is just subpar.
Right.
I'm happy that Olivia Colman kind of came up with an upset, and she was awesome on stage.
And an amazing performance.
It is, and I don't know if it's a lead, but the problem is there. It's really three leads or three supportings. And
it's three leads, yeah. But I think it's three leads.
I wish I could have, honestly, I wish you could have had like almost the best ensemble. Those three actresses were so great together.
Yes. The Favorite is a movie I'm really looking forward to seeing again.
That's a movie where when people start watching it, there's going to be a lot of people that will hate it.
Yeah.
And then
there's
going to be a lot of people going, this movie is just great. And they're going to be watching it for years.
Yeah, exactly. And that's the thing. Again, coming back to these, like, what's memorable? What do you actually want to see? What's worth seeing twice?
I will see The Favorite a second time for sure.
Yes, I will see. I've already seen Cold War twice.
I will see Roma again, but I want to see that on the big screen. I feel like it's a big screen movie.
Yeah.
And I can't wait to. I have a feeling since there are 70 millimeter prints out there, I am hoping that maybe this spring, the Somerville Theater, they do a 70 millimeter film festival.
Yeah.
And I'm hoping that gets on the cut because I definitely want to see that on the big screen.
Yeah. So I think that's a good test, though, for a movie. Like, do you want to watch it again? Is there value in watching it again? And another thing I look for in movies is, do I walk out of the theater or my living room or whatever? Do I walk out of the movie seeing the world in a slightly different way? In Green Book's favor, if you don't know about a lot of these things, you will walk out of this movie seeing the world in a different way.
I'm not here to say if you like Green Book or loved it, you're a loser. Like,
right. I mean,
if people felt like you just said that they came out feeling like they know the world differently now.
Yeah. And I definitely, you know, like I said in it, about it being a kids movie kind of, you know, I think this is a great movie for my kids to see, to learn about racism in America in a time that was not that long ago.
Well, you know that movie from a couple of years back, Hidden Figures?
Yes.
White director.
Yep.
And, it, you know, it told the story of African-Americans that hadn't been told and people didn't know about.
Exactly.
And, it wasn't my favorite film, but I think it was important. And it was good for kids. I took my son to see it, you know.
But that's kind of the thing with these movies, is that they're kind of designed to appeal to the broadest possible audience. You know, like the direction and cinematography in Green Book is like a McDonald's hamburger, right? It's maybe that's being a little unfair. What I mean, though, there's nothing really there to offend anyone. There's nothing really to dislike.
But see, I always try to look at the Academy Awards from a critic, saying, what are the very best movies, the movies I thought were the very best that deserved? And that, of course, is not what the Academy Awards are about.
Right.
So if we really just take a look at the list, though, there are positives. Black Panther, right? There is a film that was directed by an African-American.
Yes.
Nearly all African-American cast, a costume designer, production designer.
Yeah.
I mean, this is, and then this movie, right, where we had to wait so long to get a black superhero movie.
Yeah.
This movie shows that audiences will come. It was the second highest movie of the
And time. I know you don't like the movie that much, but
I don't. But I respect that.
I think it's just as good as any other Marvel movie, and in fact, better than several of them.
But see, that's my problem with it, is we're on a comparison scale of compared to other Marvel-like movies.
Yeah, I don't
and
think
not you, like compared to other movies.
No, I
it's
don't think
just
you
not that good. A
I
movie.
Don't. I don't think you can compare Marvel movies to other movies. They're their own entity.
And you know, and then look at you got Roma, and Roma is foreign language film.
Yeah.
From Mexico. And there's a chart out there. I think there was 90% of the film is speaking parts for women.
Right. Yeah.
And then Favorite had something like 63% or something. I mean, you had some years. Remember, it was sort of Oscars no women.
Yes. Oscars and Oscars so white a few years
yeah,
ago.
Yeah. And so that has changed.
Yes.
And I think that there's some positives there. In the fact that when my son was watching, there were several movies that he either knew about or had seen.
Yes.
He saw Bohemian Rhapsody with me. He saw The Favorite.
Well, and I know you didn't see it, but Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse.
I know. I really, really want to see that. I probably am going to wait now till it comes on, but I definitely
definitely. And I talked about this on the show when I saw it. But it does not look like every other 3D CGI movie. It has its own unique look and style, and it's a unique movie.
I think out of all the nominees, then there's the one that throughout the evening you start to realize, geez, the Academy doesn't seem to really like this movie. Why are they nominated? And that would be Vice.
Oh, I thought Vice and A Star Is Born.
A Star Is Born is definitely more fun.
Yeah.
Vice... I respect some of Vice, but it's really a hard movie to like.
Yeah.
He did it. I mean, Christian Bale, hands down, he became that character very unlikable. But I also think that Rami Malek did provide a hell of a lot of charisma.
Yeah, absolutely. No, he's very charismatic on screen. And it's a good performance.
Yeah, I guess. I feel like that movie really just feels like a VH1 movie.
Well, it is. Yeah, it feels like a made-for-TV movie. But yeah, his performance is probably the best part of it.
Probably.
He puts everything into that performance.
Honestly, when a movie, and that's maybe why I give his performance such high marks, is when you have a film that's put together this poorly and he's dealing with a director who's like checked out and now they have other turmoil, this guy still says, I am going to put this movie on my shoulders. And if this movie is successful, it's probably because of me. So I better do a damn good job because the rest of this movie is absolute shit.
Yes.
And he took an attitude like Freddie Mercury and said, well, I'm the shit and I'm going to make this good. So, I mean, there, I like that.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. But not necessarily the best performance of the year. But
if we can get maybe one or two films in the year that is deserving for some particular award, then great. And to me, I can't complain about the director choices. Like,
The director choices.
Roma getting best director out of the nominees, I think that was the right choice.
Yeah.
I also liked Cold War, but that was not going to win best director.
No, it was not. But. Yeah, definitely one of the best directed movies I've seen in years.
Well, anyways, gang, we've spent a lot of time on this.
One last bit of housekeeping that got lost in those two episodes.
Okay.
We have a website now.
Oh, dude, we didn't. Well, we sort of mentioned it, I think, at the end of the Valentine's episode.
I don't know.
But maybe. But okay. So, yeah, we have a website. tell us about the website, Joe.
We have a website, stuffweveseen.com. You can go there. You can find links to whatever your preferred podcasting platform is. And you can find all our episodes on the website and also some little nuggets of content that we're adding, things we think about movies. Jim is doing a really cool thing with his history of watching movies in 70mm. And we'll have little tidbits on there from time to time. So definitely.
Yeah, from time to time. We got to get some more tidbits on there.
Be getting some more tidbits on there. But in the meantime, check out our website. You can leave comments. You can contact us and let us know what you think. And if there's stuff you'd like us to cover, talk about on the show or talk about on the website, we will take suggestions.
Yeah, and Stuff We've Seen podcast is the title on Instagram.
Yes.
And I'm doing a lot on there, and there may have been a few of you that followed me along on Twitter. We did a live Twitter during the Oscars, and that actually was kind of fun.
Yeah.
Just a chance to real-time make comments.
That's what Twitter's for, is real-time.
Yeah, I'm not, I got to be honest, I don't think you're going to see that much from us on Twitter, but, you know, occasionally you might get a nugget or something.
Yeah, maybe we should live tweet while we're watching movies.
Well, okay, so that, you know, look, if there's people, I'm actually would be up for that, where we could, like, we try to sync it up as close as possible and say, go, and then watch a film and, you know, you, like, I don't know how we identify each other on the Twitter, but we could.
We could do that. Yeah.
Or we could just sit with our Taz cams and we'll record our comments, and then we will put them together later as we sort of audio track.
Okay.
Right. Well, everybody, thanks for bearing with us while we were away, and now we're back, and we will be rolling out those new episodes.
Yes. So thank you for listening.
All right. Bye, everybody.
Bye.
Tonight, words seem inadequate. In musicals, that's when we do a song. So, heaven, I'm in heaven, and my heart beats so that I can hardly speak, and I seem to find the happiness I seek when we're out together dancing cheek to cheek.